Бородатого времени суток, дорогие друзья, вы слушаете 300-й выпуск подкаста «Теория Большой Бороды», самого научно-космического русскоязычного аудиошоу, которое веду для вас я, Антон Поздняков. Сегодня юбилейный, особый выпуск, в том числе особенный он для меня, потому что наконец-то у меня получилось связаться с профессором Карлосом Фрэнком, ученым мирового масштаба. По многим версиям он был одним из номинантов на Нобелевскую премию в этом году, но в этом году он ее не получил. Я думаю, когда-нибудь он ее все-таки получит. За что именно, я думаю, вы поймете из этого выпуска. Ну и важный этот выпуск для меня, потому что у меня с профессором Фрэнком есть такой personal connection, так что я именно его решил поставить на такое красивое число, как 300. Записывали мы его на английском, подкаст доступен в двух версиях, так что переходим к интервью с профессором Фрэнком. Это оригинальная версия, дальше речь пойдет на английском, так что если вам нужна версия с переводом, если вы хотите послушать русскую озвучку, то пойдите просто в соседний выпуск, он лежит рядом в фиде с соответствующей пометкой. So, ladies and gentlemen, today is a very special day for this podcast, because in addition to the nicely looking decimal episode number 300, I also have a very special guest for you today, who has kindly agreed to come to the show. And this guest is Carlos Frank, Ogden professor at Durham University, the very university I went to study physics. And Professor Frank is also the director of the Institute of Computational Cosmology at Durham. And Professor Frank actually was one of my lecturers back then, who introduced me to the wonders of cosmology. I still remember those lectures. He is a world-class scientist, one of the originators of the cold dark matter theory. And he just recently won the Paul Dirac Medal, which is a very prestigious award. So, Professor Frank, allow me to congratulate you on this remarkable achievement. And thank you for joining me today. It's an honor and an extreme pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Anton. Well, it's my pleasure. Very nice to see you again after so many years, and it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, and I think our listeners will forgive me for a little bit of nostalgia, but before getting on to the core of our discussion, to the actual science, I would first like to ask how are things going back in Durham, which is, for those who haven't been there, and I assume a lot of our listeners didn't even know that such a place exists because it's not that popular. It's an extremely lovely and welcoming place, and the only problem with that is the climate, because it's in the north of the UK. But if you can deal with the climate, it's a very, very nice place. So how are things going back then?
Well, I mean, if you don't deal with the climate deals with you. And so you soon learn that, as the Norwegians say, there's no such thing as bad weather. It's only bad clothing, and so you just need to wear the right clothes. Anyway, so Durham is fine. As you say, it's a beautiful town. It is dominated by a cathedral that is nearly 1,000 years old. It's a fantastic site, a wonderful place. Now, of course, like everyone else, this year has been a terrible year, a very unusual year because of the pandemic. And However, I said to many friends, if you have to be in lockdown somewhere, there are few places better than Durham to be in lockdown, because it's a small place, it's beautiful, it has a riverside, you can go walk along the river, and the university closed for a while. It's open now, but only in a very restricted way. So, yes, so I feel myself I'm very lucky that I had to go through this terrible period that the whole of humanity is experiencing, in a place as beautiful and accessible as Durham.
Did the pandemic affect the actual scientific work that happens in Durham?
Absolutely. The pandemic certainly affected work. For example, the university was closed for several months, so laboratories were closed for quite a while. And And then when they reopen, well, many of these experiments take a while to get going again. So, and access to the buildings is very restricted. So most of my students and my colleagues, I haven't seen them in made of carbon atoms. I've only seen them made of silicon atoms for the last 10 months or however it is, long since March. So science requires interaction. So science is all about discussion, criticism, and it is very difficult to have productive discussions and criticisms when you're staring at a computer screen. So for us theorists, of course, the impact is less than for experimentalists, but nonetheless, it's very much there. So I'm looking forward to the end of this nightmare.
Well, I hope that it happens sooner than later. So let's go to the actual science, as I already said. Let's start with an overview question. So could you tell us a bit more about your main field of research? So I've already said that you're one of the originators of the cold dark matter theory. So can you tell us a bit more about what you do as an astrophysicist?
Well, known as a cosmologist, which is a phrase that didn't exist when I started my studies as a PhD student. The cosmologist was not the word that anybody used, because cosmology wasn't really a proper developed subfield of physics as it is now. So I'm interested in almost everything you can imagine that has to do with the cosmos, so long as it's on scales larger than individual stars. Although I am interested in those too, but I've never worked on stellar evolution, for example. So I'm very interested in the galaxy. I'm very interested in the large structure of the universe. I'm very interested in the Big Bang, in the theory of inflation. But I would say that in the last few years, my focus really has been on dark matter physics, and how can we somehow determine if the dark matter really is what the standard model of cosmology proposes it is, namely a weakly interacting massive particle produced very early on in the life of the Big Bang. So in the last few years, that's what I've been focusing on, and trying to see whether there are clues in astrophysical phenomena that might tell us something about the identity of the dark matter. And for this, we need to look on all scales, but particularly, for reasons we may discuss later, on galactic and subgalactic scales. So actually, my career started, my first paper, my thesis was on galactic studies. We found that the Milky Way had a dark matter halo. That was the first time anybody detected a dark matter halo around our own Milky Way galaxy. Did that using the dynamics of globular clusters. And most of my career I spent doing computer simulations, supercomputer simulations of the formation of large-scale structure. I worked quite a lot on quantifying the large-scale structure and seeing how we can use observations to test the theory. And now I'm back to where I began in a way. I'm now focusing on the Milky Way and smaller scales, because I think that's where the clues to the identity of the dark matter, that's where they're hiding, inside the Milky Way galaxy, in particular inside the halo of the Milky Way galaxy.
Okay, I would like to use your vast experience then. Just can you give us a brief overview of the actual development of the cold dark matter theory? So how it evolved over the years over the past decades, yeah? We can take this time scale. And what role did you have to play in it and the teams you worked with during those years?
So in fact, when I started, when I was a student, became a student in 1977 in Cambridge. At that time, a large fraction of astronomers didn't even believe that the dark matter existed, let alone that it was something exotic, like an elementary particle. After graduating in Cambridge, I went to, I had a postdoc at the University of California in Berkeley, where I arrived in 1981. Now, at that time, again, still a lot of people didn't really accept the concept of dark matter. However, some particle physicists who took the idea of dark matter seriously had proposed that maybe the dark matter was an elementary particle. And so at the time, we had an elementary particle ready-made to be the dark matter, because we knew that neutrinos exist. In fact, but until 1981, everybody thought that neutrinos were massless. However, it also is the days of the Cold War and the Iron Curtain, so there was very little communication between physicists or cosmologists in the West and in the East. Somehow, however, a paper managed to make it from Moscow to California. And this paper was co-authored by, the first author was somebody called Lyubimov. Novikov, who's a famous cosmologist, was also an author. And they claim to have measured a mass of the neutrino of 30 electron volts. Now, that was immensely exciting because we know how many neutrinos there are in the universe. We can count them. There's more or less the same number as there are photons. It's about 100 neutrinos per cubic centimeter. If you tell me what the mass is, 30 electron volts, I can multiply those two and compute the density of the universe in the form of these neutrinos. And it turns out that that density was exactly the value required to give the critical density so that the universe would have a flat geometry. So 30 electron volts would produce omega, what we call omega matter equals one, and the critical density of the universe. And so that, we thought, had to be the answer. So that's when I arrived in Berkeley. My boss, who was Mark Davis, I was a postdoc, he was a professor, he said to me, well, I've just finished the galaxy redshift survey. I'd like to know, or your job is to figure out how the structure, the large-scale structure of the universe came about. And then the other person who was there was my lifelong colleague and very good friend, Simon White. And Simon said, well, we have this measurement of a neutrino mass. It must be that the dark matter is made of neutrinos. So all we need to do is see what a universe in which the dark matter is made of neutrinos looks like, for which we needed to do computer simulations. So we did some of the first, not the very first, but some of the first computer simulations in which the universe had omega equals one, a critical density, and the dark matter was made of massive neutrinos, of Lyubimov 30 electron volt neutrinos. So we did that. I remember it was in the Christmas, actually, of 1981. I had just arrived in Berkeley, and Berkeley had just bought a new, immensely powerful supercomputer, a VAX 780 that by today's standards is less powerful than the chip in my watch. Anyway, in those days, it was an incredibly powerful computer. So we used a code to do simulations. We coded up the initial conditions appropriate to neutrinos. We evolved these, and then, to our dismay, we found that the simulations produced a universe that didn't look at all like the real universe, because there were these very large structures that had formed that had no, they were not observed in the real galaxy distribution as measured by Mark Davis in the, what it was then known as the CFA Galaxy Redshift Survey. So we were very depressed that what seemed to be a very neat solution for the universe didn't seem to work according to our simulation. So this was one of the first important results from that program, the realization that the Lyubimov experiment simply had to be wrong, because if it was right, the universe wouldn't look at all like the way it does. And sure enough, it turned out that the experiment had the wrong answer. Now, at that point, we thought, well, the neutrinos are just one type of elementary particle dark matter. There are other types. Neutrinos were called hot dark matter because these particles move very fast. They're very light neutrinos, so they're relativistic at early times. And so they have the property that they free stream out of small density perturbations. And so that's why these very gigantic structures formed. At the time, people like Dick Bond and Alex Saleh had recognized that the dark matter could be an elementary particle, but different from the neutrino, what we call cold dark matter. So these are particles that don't move at relativistic speeds at early time, or they don't move relativistically for a very long period. It's maybe just a short period of time. So they're really cold. And the result is that in this case, there's no free streaming cutoff. So the fluctuations continue on all scales. So we decided, well, let's now see if we can rule out, having ruled out neutrinos, can we rule out cold dark matter? Now, for that, we needed a better computer code than the one we had been using because it was too slow. And I knew I had a friend back in England, George Evstathew, who I knew had used a or had borrowed a code from plasma physics, then was called the P cubed M code, and it had the correct accuracy and resolution to be able to tackle the problem of cold dark matter. So we invited George to join the collaboration. So it was Mark Davies, Simon White, George Evstathew, and myself. George came over to Berkeley for a few months. He stayed in my house, I remember. He worked, I never seen anybody work that hard. He just worked all the time, all the hours of the day and the night. He hardly slept. In the end, we were able, after a year or so of developing the code, to do the first simulations of cold dark matter. So we did those, and amazingly, the output looked incredibly close to the real universe. Not only that, just for fun, because in those days, everybody thought that omega matter had to be one, that the universe had to have the critical density, but it just happened for fun. We said, well, why don't we do a simulation with a low value of omega and a cosmological constant? Just we did it just essentially out of curiosity. So that simulation is reported in our 1985 paper, where it reports the first cold dark matter simulations. And amazingly, this what is now known as the Lambda CDM cosmological model, which is a currently accepted model, is the one we ran amongst others, and it looked a lot like the real universe. So this was very encouraging. This was 1985. I mean, I'm telling you this story briefly, but it was several years. I arrived in Berkeley in 81, and it took us 4 years, really, to get these codes working and to understand what was going on. But anyway, that was the birth of cold dark matter as a serious possibility for explaining the structure of a universe. So what today we have the standard model called Lambda CDM, where CDM, of course, stands for cold dark matter. Lambda stands for Einstein's cosmological constant. And it just happens that it was exactly the model that we simulated in the 1980s. So that was the beginning of CDM. That's how it was all born. In fact, we then became known as the Gang of Four. So Davies, Evstathew, White, and I became known as the Gang of Four. This word was taken from reports of what was going on in China at the time, where Mao had died recently, and Mao's widow had put together a group of people who were running China, and they were called the Gang of Four. So why we were also known as this Gang of Four, I will never know, but that was a nickname, and it lasted for a long time, and still now people refer to the Gang of Four. Yes, yeah, so what we had was referred to the galaxy distribution. And of course, we carried out statistical tests and convinced ourselves and the world that it gave a reasonable approximation to the galaxy distribution. But, you know, the galaxies have been evolving over 13.7 billion years, and many things have happened during that time. So it was clear already from the beginning that a much better test, or not much better, but at least a more accurate test of the theory, could be done by instead looking at the early universe, not at the universe 13.7 billion years after the Big Bang, but at the universe 350,000 years after the Big Bang, which is when the microwave background radiation is emitted. Because according to the ideas at the time, and still the ideas today, the universe soon after the Big Bang underwent a period of cosmic inflation, what's known as cosmic inflation, which is describes an episode that didn't last very long. It happened just after the Big Bang, about 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang. The universe expanded exponentially fast for a very, very brief period of time, also of order 10 to the minus 35 seconds. Now, this expansion, known as inflation, was caused by the existence of some form of vacuum energy. The universe was born in a slightly unstable state, and this vacuum energy decayed, causing this exponential expansion, and also seeding the universe with small fluctuations of quantum origin. So out of inflation comes out a universe that is no longer perfectly uniform, but it has these quantum fluctuations that have been stretched to macroscopic scales by inflation. And those, according to to the theory are the progenitors of all the galaxies and all the structure that we see in the universe today. So now these small irregularities that are amplified by cold dark matter to produce galaxies, they affected the microwave background radiation, of course, because these fluctuations were fluctuations in the energy density of the universe. So one of the predictions that were made early on is that the microwave background radiation, the temperature of the microwave background radiation should not be uniform. It should have a pattern of hot and cold spots that reflect these quantum fluctuations seeded during this epoch of inflation. Now, the calculation of exactly what these fluctuations would look like, what we call the power spectrum of these fluctuations, was carried out by Jim Peebles in 1982. It's when Jim wrote this very famous paper predicting this pattern of hot and cold spots. Now, this of course offered a possibility to test the ideas of inflation and cold dark matter directly in the early universe, because if we could detect this pattern of hot and cold spots in the microwave background radiation, that would give us a very, very big indication that these ideas are correct. Well, in 1992, the 24th of April of 1992, to be precise, a team that had operated something called the COBE satellite, the NASA satellite, made an announcement. So the announcement was that, no less, that they had detected a pattern of hot and cold spots in the microwave background radiation. And the reason why I remember the date so precisely is because this really was a turning point in our understanding of the universe. This was really a watershed moment. I like to think about cosmology before the 24th of April 1992 and after, because this pattern of small irregularities in the temperature gave us direct evidence for an initial period of inflation that seeded the universe with quantum fluctuations that were then amplified by the action of this cold dark matter. Now, so of course, COBE was still a relatively simple instrument, but it didn't have very good resolution. But the same pattern was measured 10 years later by another satellite called the WMAP satellite, where W stands for David Wilkinson, one of my heroes in cosmology, who sadly died. He had designed that satellite, but died before the satellite was launched. Anyway, so that confirmed the COBE results and measured these fluctuations with greater accuracy. And then a decade later, the Planck satellite, the European Space Agency satellite, measured again this pattern of hot and cold spots with now exquisite resolution and sensitivity. And it is exactly the pattern that Jim Peebles had predicted in 1982. And as you may know, Jim Peebles got the Nobel Prize in Physics last year. It's quite interesting because Jim should have had the Nobel Prize already before, more than one. So the citation doesn't really say what exactly they're giving him the prize for. It says for contributions to cosmology. Well, this is one, not the only one of Jim's, but to me, it's possibly one of the most exciting, because he had predicted this pattern, which was then measured, and the data agree with the predictions just beautifully. So that's tests the theory at the epoch of recombination, 350,000 years after the Big Bang, and then the galaxy distribution, which in the meantime has been measured far more accurately and with far more galaxies than it was in the 1980s, tells us the same story, that the distribution of galaxies is entirely consistent with this lambda CDM model, in which the universe, I say, starts with inflation. The origin of all structures are quantum fluctuations of the inflationary field, and these fluctuations are then amplified by the gravity of the cold dark matter. So that in a universe which is expanding today again exponentially fast, just as it did during inflation, but now because of the agent of the cosmological constant. So that's where we are, Anton. We started this story in 1985, say 82 perhaps. So it is what now 40 years since the birth of this wonderful theory. And amazingly, because we thought at the time it would be, you know, we had ruled out neutrinos in a year or less, right? It didn't take long. So we felt we're going to rule out cold dark matter. Maybe it's a bit harder. Maybe it'll take us a year or two. And here we are, almost 40 years later, still unable to rule it out. So that's a brief story of the cold dark matter theory.
You already mentioned that you borrowed a script from plasma physics to run better simulations. Is my understanding that our predictions that you said Jim Peebles calculated, is it also based on the understanding of the behavior of the plasma and how things were before the recombination when the universe became opaque? So is it plasma physics again helping cosmology?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the early universe, there is this plasma, right? And because until the universe, the atoms recombine, then it is a plasma. The electrons are floating around in a sea of radiation. So we have this plasma, and the predictions that Jim made referred to the behavior of this plasma as it responds to the quantum fluctuations from inflation. So what happens is that the photon baryon fluid or plasma, so the baryons are ordinary matter, so the photon baryon fluid or the plasma that we're talking about oscillates in the early universe, producing acoustic waves. And these acoustic waves actually were known before Jim Peebles. They were known by Sakharov in the USSR, had actually figured out that these waves should be there. But Jim did the proper calculations, the full calculations, in the context of this theory that we're talking about. So plasma physics played a key role. Now, for the simulations that Stathew and Davies and White and I were doing, the code came from plasma physics, but now we were interested purely on gravity. So our simulations begin essentially at the end of this plasma era that the universe went through. So our simulations begin after recombination and just explore, at least our first simulations, now it's different, but explore the way in which gravity would cause these small fluctuations to be amplified. So the code, even though it came from plasma physics, we had to delete all the charges and all of that, because we were only interested in gravity. And it's actually quite interesting. If you look at the code, which I still have lying around somewhere, it is all written in the language of plasma physics. You know, they talk about, instead of the mass of the particle, is the charge of the particle. Of course, for our purposes, it's only the mass that matters, not the charge, and so on. So we switched off, if you like, the plasma aspects of the code, but it was exactly the same code that we needed to follow how the a large number of particles evolve under their own gravity in a universe that's initially seeded by these small fluctuations. So that was the program of simulations, and they're called embodied simulations, and they, as I say, follow the evolution of dark matter. And you know, we've been doing these simulations now for 40 years, and the simulations got incredibly good. When I started, the biggest simulations we could do had 32 cube particles, that 32,768 particles. Now, we're just, in fact, about to start the simulation with 300 billion particles. It's a third of a trillion. So we've gone from 32,000 to almost a trillion particles in 40 years. So that is, a response to the huge improvement in the capabilities of computers, and also developments of new algorithms that allow us to solve the so-called embodied problem much more accurately. But actually, in the last 5 years or so, there's been a tremendous breakthrough in the world of cosmological simulations, because whereas we could do the gravity part extremely well already decades ago, what this breakthrough is about being able to include in the simulations not only the dark matter, which is simple because it only interacts through gravity, but also the baryons, the ordinary matter that produce gas and stars and the visible side of the universe. So that's been tremendous progress, and there's been really a breakthrough by several groups in the world, three or four groups in the world, including my own here in Durham. We're now producing simulations that look a lot like the real universe, but now They look like the visible universe, you know, with stars, spiral galaxies, elliptical galaxies, supermassive black holes, the lot. So that's something very, very rewarding. So I should just say one more thing about this, that I think the problem of the distribution of the dark matter, which as I say we could calculate with these M-body simulations, I think that's a problem that's solved. So I think we solved, my generation was capable of solving the problem of what does the dark matter do, how is it distributed. We know it falls into clumps, it produces clumps. What do the clumps look like? What is the structure? So all that is well understood. Maybe I should just say one more thing for those who may have not heard about M-body simulations or the amplification of fluctuations by gravity. So the way it works is through something called the gravitational instability. So if you imagine in the early universe, out of inflation, one of these inflated quantum fluctuations, if you imagine one of those that represents a region of the universe that's slightly denser than the average, slightly over-dense, then this region that has more than average density would produce more than average gravity. And so what will happen is that because this over-density has an excess of gravitational force, well, it attracts more matter, and then it gets even more massive, more over-dense, and it attracts even more matter. And this is called an instability, and the instability stops when this object, which is initially expanding, finally collapses under its own weight, producing a clump that we refer to as a dark matter halo. So this program of M-body simulations over the last few decades showed us how dark matter halos emerge by this process of gravitational instability, how they're distributed in the universe because the galaxies form inside them, of course, and what their structure is. So I think that side of cosmology, the dark matter side, if you like, the dark side of cosmology, is a solved problem. Now the frontier now is to try and understand the visible part of the universe. And as I said, there's been a breakthrough in the last few years in the ability to include in the simulation program the much more complicated astrophysics of stars, star formation, supernovae, black holes, and so on. So it's a much more complicated problem, but there's been quite a lot of progress in that too.
Okay, so just to sum up this part, so you were initially approaching the dark matter problem from the perspective of the galaxy distribution and the follows the dark matter distribution in the universe. So the thing that was related to the CMB we were talking about, so we understand the behavior of the plasma really well. So we predicted, okay, so there should be those baryonic acoustic oscillations, basically sound waves in plasma, and we understand them really well. So if the universe was really filled with plasma before, then we should observe certain patterns, like an echo of those sound waves in the early universe. And once we've actually got a good enough resolution for the CMB, we actually observed them. And that's like a proof for the fact that dark matter should also be included in there, because our understanding of plasma includes dark matter. Is that correct?
That's a very nice summary of the situation, Anton. Yes, and so, you know, the plasma undergoes, well, it's subject to the laws of plasma physics, which are fluid mechanics of a ionized fluid. But ultimately, it also responds to the force of gravity. And the force of gravity is mostly generated by the dark matter, because we know, when we look at the composition of the universe, that about 80% of the mass in the universe is the dark matter. The visible matter is only slightly less than 20%, maybe 15% or something like that. And so even in the early universe, during the plasma era, the plasma realizes that there are potential wells produced, or incipient potential wells produced by dark matter. So the two are coupled and the two play a key role. So the plasma plays a key role in shaping the behavior of the baryons. The dark matter plays a key role of producing the gravity that eventually leads to the plasma and subsequently neutral gas, once the universe recombines, to fall into the clumps that I just described. And then eventually this gas becomes unstable. It breaks up into stars and then galaxies are formed.
Mm-hmm. The reason I was asking that is because usually, like, the conventional way of, you know, most people, I think, learn about dark matter is that dark matter is there to solve not the problem of the galaxy distribution or the matter distribution in the universe, but to solve the rotation of galaxies. That's, you know, the curve, the Vera Rubin was famous for, yeah, for measuring the rotational velocities of stars in galaxies, and that and also for Fritz Zwicky's work, you know, basically solving the problem with that there isn't enough gravity to hold stars together. And this was a bit unconventional, I feel, for I think most of our listeners to approach the dark matter problem from the other side, from a more massive scale. Because, as I said, usually I think when talking about dark matter, we're talking about, you know, the halos around the galaxies and the, you know, speeds of globular clusters that we're able to measure, and how the kinetic energy should be equal to, you know, the potential gravitational energy, and there is not enough gravity, so there should be more. But is it just because it's more verified way to talk about dark matter, or is it just because you're, as a cosmologist, you're more interested in bigger stuff?
Well, no, it's all part of the same story, right? So you're right that what keeps galaxies together is dark matter. So, but I view that just as one part of a much bigger story, or a much bigger picture, which is the universe as a whole. So the dark matter is dominant because from the gravitational point of view, so it dominates on all scales, from dwarf galaxies to galaxies like the Milky Way to galaxy clusters, and indeed to the entire galaxy distribution, the so-called cosmic web. So everywhere we look, the dark matter is pervasive. It's everywhere. Now, so the of course, the evidence for the existence of dark matter comes in part from the rotation curves of galaxies, although, interestingly, in the days of Vera Rubin, the flat rotation curves of galaxies that she found aren't really evidence for dark matter, because you could still get the same behavior that she found without dark matter. But that's a small point. Nowadays, we use rotation curves as one form of evidence, empirical evidence for dark matter. We also, there are other forms of evidence, for example, gravitational lensing, which is the distortions in the images of galaxies that or quasars produced by as light travels throughout the universe and feels the gravitational field of the dark matter, and then it gets deflected and the images are distorted. So this is a phenomenon of gravitational lensing, and it tells us about how much dark matter there is on a much larger scale than galaxies. So that's another source of evidence for the existence of dark matter. But yes, I mean, dark matter really really holds the strings of the universe on all scales, say from dwarf galaxies all the way to the cosmic web. So it's all, galaxies are just one part of a much bigger picture, which is the universe. And that picture is being drawn in detail by the action of dark matter.
Another thing I want to talk to you about is computational cosmology as a concept. So I would first like to touch the Durham facility a bit. As I said, you are the director of the Institute of Computational Cosmology at Durham. So can you tell our listeners a bit more about what's the actual facility like? Because I assume a lot of them heard about the results that, you know, there are supercomputers that simulate those complex things about the universe. But I think not many actually imagine how it actually works.
So I should clarify, Anton, that I'm the founding director of the Institute, but I stepped down as director after 20 years, just last year. So I'm now no longer the director. So the director is my colleague, who was the deputy director, Sean Cole. But I was the director. I created the Institute, and I directed it for 20 years. But after 20 years, I thought, well, that's enough to be running an Institute. And as I'm not getting any younger, and I still want to solve, at least as far as possible, from the point of astrophysics, the problem of the dark matter, then I decided I need all my time to do research, and I let someone else run my institute. So anyway, so in the institute we have this very large computer, which we call the cosmology machine. And so I'll tell you the way it works in a second, but this is the cosmology machine has been there also for 20 years. So when the institute was born, part of the birth was a big computer, and it gets renewed every 3 or 4 years. And just now, it's very exciting because today is Tuesday, but on Thursday, I'm signing a very, very big check for many millions of pounds to buy the new installment of the cosmology machine. So it's known affectionately as COSMA for short, and this will be COSMA 8. So we're now on the 8th version of the cosmology machine. So this is a big computer, and we use it only for cosmological simulations. It doesn't do anything else. It just uses, it's all dedicated to, well, almost all dedicated to computer simulation. Some of it is used for gravitational waves as well. But the lion's share of these supercomputers is dedicated to computer simulations. So how do you do a computer simulation? So let me tell you how you do that. And it's relatively simple. In detail, it's complicated, but in practice, in principle, it's simple. So in computational physics, you need to know two things. You need to know the starting point, the initial state of the system you want to study, and then you need to know the evolution equation. Now, if you know those two, then it's just a simple problem, a computational problem to solve the relevant equations. Now, that's exactly the situation we have in computational cosmology, because we know the initial conditions. That's the these quantum fluctuations from inflation, and the inflation tells us exactly what the nature of these perturbations should be on different scales. So we know the initial conditions. We also know, as part of the initial conditions, the contents of the universe. We know that the dark matter makes up 25% of what the universe contains, that ordinary matter of baryons makes 5%, and that dark energy makes the remaining 70%. So that's the initial state. And then we also know the relevant equations of physics. We know that gravity is important, and gravity is described by general relativity, but also by Newtonian physics in the regime we're interested in. Relativistic effects are only important on the scale of the whole universe, but not on the scale of the formation of large structure or galaxies. Then we can get away just using Newtonian dynamics. However, to describe the expansion of the universe, then we do need general relativity. And we know the right equations, the Friedman equation, which I taught you, Anton, when you were an undergrad here.
I do remember that. I do remember writing down the Friedman equations and all this stuff and cracking my head around it. So that's what it was for, yeah? So if I learned the Friedman equation, I could then plug them into the sim computer and it will simulate the universe for me.
Well, you need a few more things. You also need the Poisson equation, because the Poisson equation relates the potential to the mass, and the potential is what produces velocities. And so that basically the three equations you need to solve if you're only interested in dark matter is the Friedman equation, Newton's equation, and Poisson's equation. And then that is all you need. And then you need to program the computer to solve these equations given the initial state, and there you are. Now, of course, it's more complicated because the universe is very big. And so if you want to be able to solve the equations in the regime of interest, you better do it in a very efficient way. By the way, you might wonder why you need computers. Well, you need computers because the problem is, as we say in physics, strongly nonlinear. So there's no analytical solution in the strongly nonlinear case, because the equations are all complicated and they have they feed onto one another. And so it's nonlinear. It's what we call nonlinear. So that's why you need to solve the equations in a computer. You couldn't possibly solve them with a pen and paper. But that's why, you know, the problem is, I say, it's relatively simple. In practice, it's difficult because the codes have to be super efficient. And so the numerical methods are very, very, very sophisticated. Now, then, that's what you do to do a computer simulation if you're only interested in dark matter. Now, if you're interested in the visible part of the universe, then it gets a lot more complicated, because then you have to solve many more equations that describe the plasma, describe the fluid, describe the way in which this plasma makes stars. And then what's much harder than anything else is understanding how the results of stellar evolution feed back onto the dynamics of the gas, because stars, as we know, explode, producing supernovae. They then are a source of energy that's injected into the plasma that then whose behavior is then changed. And so this is called feedback, and it's quite complicated. And then to make it even more interesting and more complicated, we know that all galaxies have supermassive black holes at their centers, including the Milky Way. In fact, the Nobel Prize in Physics this year was given to three people, to Roger Penrose, Reinhard Genzel, and Andrea Goetz, who discovered, well, not Penrose. Penrose did the theory, but Genzel and Goetz discovered the supermassive black hole in the center of the Milky Way.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to know your opinion on that, because that's a very controversial topic that we had here, and I discussed it with several other scientists. Some are very conservative, because they say it's not a supermassive black hole, it's a super compact object, or whatever they call it. So they avoid the black hole word. So do you actually think that those are black holes, or they might be black hole-like objects?
Well, that's why Penrose was part of the three, right? Penrose showed that that black holes are the inevitable end product of the collapse of gravitating structures, not just stars, because in this case it's not the collapse of one star, or at least maybe at the beginning it was. But anyway, but from an empirical point of view, well, you could be nitpicking. Say, well, how do you know it's a black hole? Well, I think some of these stars get very close to the event horizon. And so I think for all practical purposes, it is a black hole. I mean, how can you have a super compact object that produces those velocities that we observe in such with a rapid variability and on the short, very short distances that are observed? Well, Penrose told us that if you have a compact object that massive, it will implode and produce a black hole. So I know that there are people who are skeptical, and that's right. I mean, in science, skepticism is vital. So Martin Rees says that science is only organized skepticism. And yes, I agree with that. So one should be critical, but there comes a point where the evidence is just pretty overwhelming. And so we're entitled to call this a supermassive black hole.
Okay, and coming back to the simulations, so I think one thing that would be really interesting for my particular audience, who most of whom are, you know, tech-savvy people who like gadgets and computers and stuff, can you reveal a bit more about the hardware that's used in there? So are there any specifically designed hardware for computer simulations of for cosmology? Do you require, I don't know, special nodes, like, for example, you know, Google uses those special chips for TensorFlow for their own purposes? Are there any specific hardware for the computers that, let's say, used in Durham? I assume you said that you'll be writing a big check for a bunch of new hardware. So what's the most important part for a supercomputer like that? Is it the processors? Is it GPUs that you need to stack up in the nodes? And so what's the most important part in terms of hardware, and what part of computer tech evolution gave you the most punch in terms of the progress of the field?
Well, it's a very good question. So the key point is that we need many, many computers, if you like, many processors working together. So each individual core, as they're called now, or node, as a collection of cores is known, they're just ordinary chips. They're ordinary, you know, Intel or AMD chips. Like you would have in your laptop. And so what is crucial is the large number of them and the fact that they have to be connected in a way that is very efficient. So the so-called latency, which is the speed at which two cores or two processors communicate, has to be very, very fast. So the latency has to be very small, meaning they communicate very fast. So what's the most important thing for these supercomputers is what we call the interconnect, which allows different chips to know what the other chips are doing, so they can all work, cooperate and work together. So, for example, the I don't know exactly, I'm waiting for the quote today, but we will be buying of order 100,000 cores or chips or CPUs, and we want to use them all. So the way they are interconnected to one another, that really is the factor that determines the speed at which a computer can solve the problem. Now, there are specialized chips like GPUs, but for our codes, which are very complex, GPUs, they just don't work, because the problem we're trying to solve, it boils down to the fact that gravity has essentially an infinite reach. And so you have one place in the universe, in principle, knows about the gravity produced everywhere else in the universe. In principle, of course, the force decays like 1 over r squared, so it gets weaker and weaker, but you need to, with distance, but you need to take into account the fact that gravity is a pervasive force. And so that's one reason why it's so hard to write the problem for GPUs, which are much faster than CPUs. So we've tried and failed to do that. Now, other people have been able to write simpler codes in many ways in GPUs, which are immensely fast. But I don't think, well, not that I know, that you could do the complicated cosmological hydrodynamics simulations that we're doing nowadays with GPUs. So it's quite simple. You know, a supercomputer, the ones that we use, are just a collection of a large number of CPUs connected in an extremely efficient way by some interconnect that is effective and efficient. So that's all there is. So we don't care about anything else.
So the bottleneck is then in those interconnections. So the main problem is not the raw computational power that you're getting from all those chips, because you can always, you know, order some more and get even more computational power, but it's about making them work together, making them talk to each other, because I believe that that's what the main problem is for the chip makers, because they are not making thousands and thousands of cores, because it's the same problem within the chip. Yeah, you need to make those cores talk to each other and exchange information and understand what's everybody doing. So the problem with supercomputers then is pretty much the same, right? Am I correct here? Right.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, and then the challenge is, because you have so many, then they first of all require lots of energy, so they use lots of electricity. So running one of these supercomputers is extremely expensive. For example, the supercomputer that we have in Durham uses a significant fraction of the whole electricity for the whole city. But then that's one part. And the other part is that, of course, chips are producing, they have electrical currents going through them, so they heat up. So they produce lots of heat. And so keeping them cool is what actually requires a lot of electricity, because the system has to be continuously being cooled. And if there's a fault or something, then everything can melt. So that's the challenge, packing together lots and lots of chips and making sure that they can talk to one another efficiently, and also that being able to cool them down effectively. So those are the challenges that the supercomputer industry faces. I mean, of course, the faster the chip, the better, but I think the speed of computer chips is not really increasing anymore. The Moore's law is kind of stopped now. And so now the challenge is not so much the speed of individual chips, but how effectively they communicate, and how do you keep them cool, and how do you stop your bill for electricity exploding. So those are the challenges.
And what kind of assumptions do you have to make when setting the picture up? So as you said, in the basics, the computational cosmology isn't that hard. You give the initial conditions, you give the evolution equations, and you let it run, so you get the result. But what kind of assumptions do you need to make in terms of, you know, the scales, maybe balance the number of particles against the overall size of the simulation? Maybe you need to sacrifice resolution, either spatial or temporal. So what kind of trade-offs do you have to do when doing a simulation? Because ideally you would, you know, simulate the whole universe, but that's definitely not the case. We cannot do that, especially sped up at the time that we want. So what kind of trade-offs are there when developing a simulation?
Yeah, before I answer that question, so just one thing, if there are people in the audience who are interested in this, many of the simulation codes are public, so you can just download them and run them. There's a very famous code called Gadget that was written by a colleague of mine, Volker Springel, in the Max Planck Institute in Garching. So Gadget is a public code, and over the last few years in Durham, we've developed a new code called Swift, which is also open source, so people can download it and play with it. Now, so to answer your question, what assumptions do we make? Well, we make very few assumptions. In fact, we make no assumptions, really, other than the initial conditions, which come from inflation. But the simulations do have some limitations, and that's because, as you say, the universe is very big, and we only have finite computing resources. So, for instance, if we think in terms of gravity, which is the simplest problem, then gravity is represented by particles. And then you only have, whereas in reality, in the real universe, the dark matter is not, well, it is made of particles, but of particles much smaller than the ones that we can afford to simulate if we want the cosmological volume. So typically, in a cosmological simulation, say a really, really big one, the one particle will weigh 10 to the 7 times 10 million times the mass of the sun, although we've just done some simulations with much smaller masses. But typically, for a cosmological simulation, 10 to the 6, well, not 10 to the 6 is too much, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 and above are the particle masses. So that then, you're representing then what's a continuum, pretty much, which is the gravitational field in discrete lumps called particles, and that introduces discreteness effects. Now, in particular, if you have two particles that come very close together, then they suffer in principle, when they get very, very close, the gravitational force tends to infinity, and computers don't like infinity. And so what we need to do is modify gravity on small scales slightly using something called the softening parameter, which then avoids these singularities in the calculation. So the force, gravitational force, instead of continuing to increase like 1 over r squared, becomes constant on very small scales, at least on tiny scales, to avoid these infinities. So that's one sort of limitation. It has to do with the fact that we're representing what's in effect a continuous field by discrete particles. And then another one is, as you say, the time resolution, the time step. So you're integrating the equations in time, but you can only afford... you cannot wait the age of the universe to solve your problem. You have to do it in a reasonable amount of time. So you take time steps, you discretize the differential equations. The equations we're talking about are differential equations. You discretize them, and then you take time steps. And so another limitation is the size of the time step. So if the time step is too long, for example, then you don't follow the orbits of particles correctly. But if the time step is too short, then the simulation takes forever. And so that's another compromise you have to make between accuracy of the integration and time to solution. So there are compromises like that. Those two are the main ones. Now, this is when we're interested in dark matter. When you're interested now in the more complicated problem of hydrodynamics and baryons, then you do need to make quite a lot of more assumptions. Like, for example, because the simulations don't resolve the molecular clouds where stars form in a cosmological volume, we don't have enough resolution for that, then we need to introduce models of what we think the gas would be doing if we were able to resolve it. So this goes by the generic name of subgrid physics. So that's physical processes that are not resolved in the simulation and need to be modeled in some way. That's only the case for hydrobaryonic cosmological simulations. For the dark matter only simulations, the only limitations are what I said, time step and softening parameter. But for hydro, then there's many, many more assumptions, because of course we don't resolve, as I said, molecular clouds. We don't resolve the black holes either. So these are all treated using models which are known as subgrid physics models.
And I think I have just a couple more questions for you. What do you think are the next milestones, next important milestones for both computational cosmology and the CDM model? What do you think will come next in the nearest future?
Well, what should come next is the discovery of the dark matter particles, because, I mean, we have overwhelming evidence that it is there, but the particles have not yet been discovered in the laboratory. So that is, I think, what should come next, and I hope it will come next. I mean, I must say that many years ago, I don't like to bet, but I did make a bet with someone that the dark matter particles would be discovered before gravitational waves. And it looks like I lost my bet. Although I'm not completely sure I've lost, actually, because there are some people who claim to have already discovered dark matter, but nobody, I mean, there's a lot of skepticism about this, including a Ukrainian friend of mine who claims to have discovered a type of dark matter called the sterile neutrino, which is not the same as the Lyubimov neutrino, it's a different kind of neutrino. But anyway, there's lots of skepticism about this. But I would think that the discovery of the dark matter must surely be the next milestone in cosmology.
But will it be done by particle physicists then?
Well, yes and no. So I'm getting very impatient with the particle physicists. You know, they've been looking for them for 40 years and still don't find them. So I think in astrophysics, we may be able... It wouldn't be the same, obviously, as finding a particle in the laboratory, but we can come very close to ruling out or testing cold dark matter. And that has that the way this this is what I'm spending most of my research time doing. The basic prediction of cold dark matter is that there should be a very, very large number of very small halos of masses all the way to the mass of the Earth. So that those are the smallest halos that form. And so if we could find some of these, maybe not Earth masses, too small, but even halos of 10 to the 6, solar masses 10 to the 7, which are completely dark, they never make a galaxy, they're too small. Then if we found those, then I think that would pretty much be a confirmation of the theory. And if we fail to find them, that would rule out the theory. So I think that's an exciting arena from the point of view of astrophysics. But ultimately, I mean, the real conclusive proof has to be discovering a particle in the laboratory. And then, you know, there are experiments going on all over the world trying to find these dark matter particles. Whoever finds them will not only get the Nobel Prize, that would be the least they would pass on to the history books as having made one of the most important breakthroughs in science ever, because we know that dark matter is a predominant form of matter in the universe, and it's also responsible for our existence, responsible for the formation of galaxies. Computationally, well, I think maybe, you know, quantum computers one day might be useful for this problem. Of course, we don't know whether they will happen at all at any large scale, but if they do, they could maybe allow us to do what you said was not possible, which is to simulate the whole universe. Maybe with a quantum computer, we can increase the resolution such that we resolve even the formation of stars at the same time as we resolve the whole cosmic web on the scale of gigaparsecs. But I wouldn't hold my breath. I think the prospects of discovering dark matter are much greater than the prospects of using a quantum computer to simulate the whole universe.
Well, there are also limits on even quantum computing that we can actually do. So I think there will still be quite limited to whether we can actually simulate the whole universe. But hopefully, they will bring something something new to the field and help us understand. Well, basically, as you said, if we get a better computer, it would allow us to get better resolutions. So basically simulate smaller particles, get bigger sizes of the simulation, and also get smaller temporal resolution, so smaller time steps. And so the last question for today, it's more of a hypothetical question. So let's imagine you had a time machine and you could go 100 years ahead and basically go to Durham to the same lab that you're working in, and there will be, you know, somebody else working on the same in the same field. What would be the first question you would ask them?
Well, the first thing I would say to them is, I'm so pleased to see you, to see that humanity has survived this time, and that there's still people doing science and still worrying about the mysteries of the universe. That's the first thing I would say, because we shouldn't take for granted that even civilization as we know it, or science as we do it today, will continue into the indefinite future. I mean, this pandemic has shown how vulnerable humanity is, and so that's just one of the many challenges that we face. And so that was the first thing I would say, is how pleased I am to know that there's still people alive and doing science 100 years from now. Then, having got that out of the way, I would the question I would ask them is, if I say the word Lambda CDM, do you laugh or do you look at me seriously? Was it all a completely crazy idea, or is this really the way the universe works? That's what I would ask them.
Well, that's a very interesting thing. Yeah, I hope that we will have an opportunity like that in the nearest future, and that our lifespan will be enough to get the answers to this question, to know whether whether it's confirmed or whether something else goes into its place. So, Professor Frank, thank you very much for joining me for today. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And, you know, if we had time, we would probably talk to you for much, much longer, because I have a lot of questions about a lot of things which you can answer. So hopefully someday we can meet again and talk about space and cosmology for a bit more.
Well, it'll be a pleasure, Anton. It's been a great pleasure to speak to you today. And thank you very much for inviting me. I look forward to having another conversation, maybe not in 100 years, but before then. And in the meantime, I wish you all the best with your podcasts. And I hope you and your audience found something interesting in what I said tonight. And thank you very much for the invitation, and all the best.
Yeah, all the best to you too. Что ж, вот таким получился 300-й выпуск подкаста «Теория большой бороды». Надеюсь, вам понравилось. Как я сказал, для меня это был очень важный выпуск. Надеюсь, вы тоже его оценили. Напоминаю, что лучший подарок, который вы можете сделать для подкаста, это поставить ему оценку или написать отзыв в приложении Apple Podcasts. Ну а если вам совсем нравится то, что я тут делаю, можете занести небольшую денежку на Patreon, выбрав там тариф, который содержит «Теорию большой бороды». И так вы будете поддерживать подкаст и получать дополнительные выпуски после шоу. Также не забывайте подписываться на мой новый YouTube проект. Давайте разбираться, ссылочки будут в описании. Ну и на этом я с вами сегодня буду прощаться. Ждите новых крутых гостей, ждите новых сольных выпусков. В общем, я надеюсь, что у «Теории большой бороды» все еще впереди, и 300 выпусков — это далеко не предел. На этом прощаюсь, да пребудет с вами сила, до следующего четверга и пока-пока.